So what I'd like to speak about this afternoon is gladdening the mind. And I'd like to begin by reading you a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. It's called So Much Happiness. It's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there's something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches, and love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there is no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands, and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. Contentment is probably one of the most rare and precious gifts in life. It can seem so hard to find. And yet in the moments we glimpse contentment, it feels like our whole world is filled with ease. Now the discontented mind we mostly experience when we're heroically striving to be something we are not, and to have something we don't have. Happiness and contentment is sometimes no further away from us than our next breath, than opening our heart to the moment we're in, and releasing this striving and struggle to be something we are not. Life really doesn't have to be perfect for us to find peace. Our minds and our hearts and our bodies certainly don't have to be perfect for us to find contentment. And our meditation really does not have to be perfect for us to find happiness and contentment. But they do ask us to give things up, to give up covetousness, to give up resistance, to give up fear. Siddhartha, as a young ascetic, was initially totally committed to transcending or trying to transcend an imperfect world. In fact, he had a 7-year aversion attack. And then one day, after so much struggling to be something he was not, he remembered a time when he was a small boy, when he sat on the hillside and looked down on a farmer plowing his field. And he remembered in that moment being filled with this sublime contentment and peace, that there was nothing missing, nothing that could be added to that not very special day, nothing that could be added to make it more perfect. When we come on a retreat, in the beginning we have often a difficult day. And it feels difficult because we are meeting so directly everything that seems so imperfect. And because there is nowhere really to hide from our bodies, from our minds, from what is happening in our meditation. And then we often have doubt. We often feel a little disheartened, and we tell ourselves that all the stories we've heard about how impossible meditation practice is are all true. We tell ourselves that all the suspicions we've harbored about this path being grim and somber and miserable are all being proved to be true. The Buddha never taught that this is a path of misery leading to ultimate misery. Instead, he taught that this is a path of happiness that leads to the highest happiness. And contrary to much of what we may believe or have heard, the Buddha spoke often of joy and contentment, and the joy of a gladdened heart. He spoke of the happiness that is born of a collected mind, of a calm heart, the happiness born of concentration, of seclusion, of letting go. He spoke of loving kindness and compassion and appreciative joy and equanimity as being sources of profound happiness and contentment. And he spoke very often of the joy of a liberated mind. And I think sometimes when we hear this, we respond to it, this is what we would like. But we tend to be very often dualistic in our understanding of it. Too often we think that first we're supposed to suffer, and then later on, as some kind of reward for that suffering, we might be happy. That first we need to struggle, and that later on, at some mysterious point, we're going to find contentment. Personally, I would suggest that it's really much more helpful to ask ourselves what it would mean for us to have our practice unfold in a climate of happiness. To ask ourselves what we need to cultivate, to bring into being, for us to gladden our minds. I'd even encourage you to take as a koan or as a reflection the instruction and the encouragement of the Buddha that in the mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. That in a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. Now, in this practice, wise attention is very much placed at the beginning and in the center of a path of deepening. It's said that profound and transforming insight are born of a calm and still mind. That compassion, our capacity to reach out to embrace sorrow, is born of stillness and receptivity. We know, certainly in our own experience, that all of the moments when we've been deeply touched by anything at all in life, the moments of intimacy, of love, are also the moments when we've been wholeheartedly present and awake. It's clear in our own experience that to listen, to see, to feel anything at all deeply, we need to be attentive. We need to be present. So today we've begun, breath by breath and step by step, moment to moment, to cultivate our capacity to be present for wise attention. And as we do this, I think it's very important to keep close to us this reflection that wise attention grows in a climate of happiness. Now, probably one of the first things that you've noticed today is that there seems to be an almost intrinsic tension in cultivating wise attention. The mind just doesn't want to be here. Anywhere but here. We see this often in our life. It's a tension we encounter again and again. One thing that we see is that we're happy to attend to things that are pleasant. If I encourage you, just go out and enjoy the flowers, you know, watch a movie, listen to some music, you know, have a nice meal, be with someone you love. Probably never want to be somewhere else. We're happy to be attentive. If in your meditation today you'd experienced endless rapture, profound insights, uplifting experiences, you'd probably be glued to your cushion. Right? No one would want to go home. We find ourselves paying attention to the unpleasant only if there is absolutely no alternative. Only if we've exhausted all of our strategies of avoidance and distraction and resistance. And we see in our life and in our practice when something is neutral, and there is an awful lot in our life that is actually really quite neutral, mostly our attention just slides away. We say it's boring, or we dismiss it. So here is the first tension, and actually the first very big insight that we have in our practice. To know the difference between this kind of attention that loves the pleasant, hates the unpleasant, dismisses the neutral, to know the difference between this kind of attention, which in some traditions is called a childlike concentration, to know the difference between that and what is wise attention. And I think wise attention could be defined very simply as the willingness to attend to all things with equal respect. The willingness to meet the pleasant and the unpleasant and the neutral equally. And a very big question in our life and in our practice is, are we willing to do that? To do that, to meet all things with equal respect, I think requires quite a radical change of attitude and a considerable amount of insight. But that attitude and insight is what determines whether this tension in developing wise attention, it determines whether that tension is going to be negative and exhausting or whether it's going to be creative. Now, we cannot force ourselves into wise attention. If we try to force ourselves, all that it creates is more tension and contractedness. It is really the qualities of deep ease, of interest, of investigation, and of happiness that allows wise attention to unfold. So we have our breathing. We begin. Mindfulness of breathing is in the service of cultivating wise attention and insight. Within the body of the breath, we explore what it means really to gather and to collect ourselves, to be awake within the body of our breath. And we also explore what it means to gladden our minds, to gladden our hearts. And in this talk, I'd just like to look at just a few of the building blocks of gladness. The first of the building blocks of gladness that the Buddha spoke about is generosity. The Buddha spoke of generosity as being the cornerstone, the heart of a meditative life. And not just material giving, but the gift of fearlessness and the gift of the Dharma. All the teachings of generosity really have at their heart a willingness to let go. not holding. This is not just some fine theory. I'm sure we all experience any time in our life very, very directly that when we are clinging or holding to anything at all, the effect is immediate. I mean, have you ever experienced clinging and gladness in the same moment? Doesn't work. The effect is immediate. The result is this immediate contraction, tightness. And it's important to know that very deeply. Because I think we could shout at ourselves for a million years to let go. And yet, unless we really understand that we let go out of kindness, that we let go out of compassion, that letting go in truth is what gladdens our lives and hearts. So then a very real question is, how are we generous to ourselves in our practice? You know, sometimes people, when they're on the first day of a retreat, you know, they tell me, oh, I'm so tired, you know, I'm so bored, I'm so dull, you know. I really have to take care of myself. And I think, well, how are you going to do that? And so people come up with some wild ideas, you know, like maybe I'll order a pizza, you know. Or maybe I'll just go to sleep. This is not a way of kindness. The greatest way of kindness in the midst of discomfort is actually to let go of the discontent that really makes its roots so in our heroic struggles to be what we are not in this moment. To have what we do not have in this moment. So we learn about contentment. We learn about what it means to be contented with agitation, to be contented with grumpiness, to be contented with the chaotic mind, the resistant heart. The Tibetans tell a story about a wealthy king who could never appreciate all that he had, which was much, who could never enjoy all of the loveliness that filled his world, who could never rest. In fact, the very nature of this king was always to covet what other kings had that he didn't feel he had. Now, the name of this king, as unlikely as it sounds, was King Hard to Please. And whenever I hear this or whenever I've read this story, it always makes me smile because I'm sure we've all met Ms. Hard to Please and Mr. Hard to Please in our practice. What we are meeting in that is our difficulty and sometimes our downright refusal to be with discomfort. You know, we came on a retreat, you know, perhaps we expected the Ritz, you know, perhaps we expected bliss and we get a wayward mind. But can you imagine any single person in this world who always has lovely thoughts, who always has a body that's delightful, who's always surrounded by people that they love, who only has uplifting emotions? I would suggest that no one in the history of humankind has yet managed to achieve that. And I feel really quite assured that I'm at least not going to be the first. Mm-hmm. So we meet an imperfect world, inwardly and outwardly. And in the midst of that imperfect world, we're asked to explore what contentment is. It's not the fact that we don't get what we want that contracts us. It's not the fact that we are not always who we want to be that contracts us. It is the wanting and even the demand that contracts us. So we learn to let go of that hungry creature out of kindness. Kabir once wrote, He said, I said to this wanting creature inside me, what is this river you want to cross? Do you believe there is some place that will make the heart less thirsty? In that great absence, you will find nothing. Enter into your body. There you have a place to rest. Throw away the thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are. Out of generosity, we learn to let go, not just once, but many times, of preoccupation. With our obsession endlessly about how things should be. Said in this teaching that preoccupations do not end until the day that we die, but they end when we put them down. That is their nature. There's so much that we can think and worry about. Our plans for the future, our regrets about the past. We can obsess about almost anything in this world. And when we look at all of the things that we obsess about, a good question to ask of ourselves really is, does the obsession really make any difference at all? Does it enable skillful action? Does it actually bring about any more insight? Or is it at times just a habit? When I think of obsession, I think it's kind of like chewing gum. You know, you've been chewing gum for hours, the same piece of gum, and your jaws are working it over and they're getting really tired and the gum is all dried out and has no flavor and no juice anymore. But it doesn't occur to us that maybe this piece of gum is done. You know? And it might be wise and kind to ourselves just to take it out. I think what we do see in obsession is how little gladness there actually is, but instead how there is this undercurrent of anxiety and busyness. So with generosity in our practice, we learn to put them down again and again. And each time we do that, we lighten just a little bit the load, the burden that we can all carry. We learn to put them down again and again just by coming back that one moment to breathe just this one breath. To walk just this one step, to listen to just this one sound wholeheartedly. And each time we do that, we begin to taste just a little bit the flavor of gladness. The gift of fearlessness is another aspect of generosity. Sometimes it's giving refuge to those who have no place of safety. Times it's protecting beings who have no protection, of being a friend to someone who has no companion. Generosity is sometimes just moving a small creature out of harm's way, of challenging injustice. But the gift of fearlessness is something we also learn to offer to ourselves in our practice. Aversion and fear are truly the proximate causes of disconnection in our life. We see this so clearly. And in truth, there is so much that we can find in ourselves to turn away from. All of the thoughts, all of the emotions, all of the experiences that we condemn or dismiss or judge or reject in ourselves. And in truth, we can do this so often that we entirely forget what it means to be a friend to ourselves, what it means to protect ourselves, what it means to be a refuge to ourselves. So it is out of generosity that we learn to cultivate in our practice a culture of non-abandonment. Not abandoning anything. Our practice is and can express a profound generosity through our willingness to attend wholeheartedly to everything that appears in the moment. A sound, a wandering thought, one breath, with a mind and heart of respect. Knowing that this is worthy of our attention. The mind begins to taste gladness. The gladness that comes when we're able to say to our life, this too, this too. It's sometimes said that the world is full of choices, and at times the only choice we have is what attitude we will have. Mudita, or appreciative joy, is another thread in the fabric of gladness. In fact, in Pali, the word mudita is translated as a heart of gladness. In the Zen tradition, there's a haiku that says, although I am in Kyoto when the cuckoo sings, I long to be in Kyoto. It's so easy to go through our life with a mind, a heart that feels there is just not enough. Not enough of anything to truly complete us, to enliven us, to bring joy. And appreciative joy is really learning to delight in all that is well, in all that is lovely, in all that makes our hearts sing in the midst of the imperfect. When we meet our aching back or our wayward mind or our frustration or disappointment or doubt or our busyness, we're so sure that we are far from Kyoto. But the more indignant we become, the more insulted we feel, the more tight and contracted we find ourselves. Last week I was teaching at Spirit Rock, and one of the phenomena at Spirit Rock are these flocks of wild turkeys. And they are the most indignant creatures on earth. You only need to look at them, and they do this big ruffle and hustle and spitting and hissing. And if they see themselves reflected in the paintwork of the cars, they do it all day long, just ruffling and huffling and hissing at themselves. And it's a sort of epitome of contractedness. I often think of this turkey mind, you know, that is going through life so indignant and so contracted and so... it seems so far from Kyoto. But it's also, we all know, how easy it is in our lives to focus only on that which is broken. To focus only on that which is flawed and imperfect, inwardly and outwardly. And we know that when we do that, gladness feels very, very far away, and it's replaced by contractedness. And when we focus only on the broken and imperfect, so easily we slide into aversion. We slide into judgment, comparison, almost suffocating our capacity for gladness. Shantideva once said, we fear pain and rush headlong into it. That we long for happiness and crush it like an enemy. It is very true that all that is broken in our lives, in ourselves, needs a great deal of attention. needs tremendous care, tremendous compassion, and we also need in those moments a deep sincerity of heart that knows how not to enter into contractedness in the face of the broken, that still knows how to find that place of contentment and joy that is part of mudita. I always feel that nature is a great ally in cultivating a heart of gladness. To allow ourselves to delight in the small miracles and moments of life and beauty that touch our hearts. You walk outside here to allow ourselves to notice the flowers that bud in spring, the stillness of the trees, the birds in the sky, the sound of the wind, to take the time in our day to see and listen wholeheartedly. We begin to sense the way that that wholehearted attentiveness in truth really does illuminate our mind and our world. And sometimes that wholehearted attention is what really opens the closed doors of our heart. And being touched, allowing ourselves to be touched, is not a sacrifice of mindfulness. It is not a denial of the imperfect, but allows us to meet it. The mindfulness practice, this path of awakening, is a way of stepping out of this conventional belief that our happiness depends upon someone or something making us happy. The belief and the suffering that comes with the externalization of happiness and joy and well-being. The really radical shift we make in this practice is instead of prowling the world, seeking for things to delight us, we are awakening our capacity to be delighted. We are awakening our capacity to feel joy, to celebrate the blessings of the moment. I'm not a very easy person, and the mornings are not good for me, which my partner always says to me. He says he can't understand why I start retreats so early in the morning. He says, you are hardly even civil to yourself in the morning. You know, how can you be civil to anybody else? And one morning I was teaching with a dear friend of mine, and I'd arrived, and I was in my usual rather kind of early morning state of mind. And Fred started saying to me, he started asking me, he says, did you wake up healthy this morning? I said, yeah. He says, did you have food to eat? I said, yeah. He says, did your car start? And I said, yeah. He said, did you break down on the way here? I said, no. He says, did you get here and all the yogis are still here? I said, yeah. And I could feel myself, I was getting happier and happier by the moment. And it wasn't something that it was contrived. But it was an awareness of how when we're contracted, nothing can touch us. Nothing makes our hearts sing. We get so disconnected from that which is lovely, inwardly and outwardly. There is a way of practicing in which that sense of appreciation, of receiving, is really at the heart of our practice. Noticing what is well. It is not perfect, but our capacity to meet the imperfect, our capacity to bear the imperfect, is made so much easier by our willingness to soften and to relax, to release this demand that life must be other than it is. That we must be other than we are. Because we do see that when our heart is closed, the world is really closed to us. That when we don't or can't see fully or openly, nothing can touch us. That when our mind is weary or tired, everything looks dark and tired to us. The aliveness and the love that we long for really begins with enlivening our own hearts. Rumi once said, Sufi poet once said, today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study, take down a book and begin reading, take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Another great ally in the heart of gladness is the cultivation of spaciousness. And sometimes I think when people hear the word spaciousness, they feel kind of puzzled. What is that? We know what it is like to be spacey, right? To be disconnected and dull and have this mind that is wandering and meandering everywhere. But spaciness is not what is meant by spaciousness. A friend of mine who's a monk, he told me a story about when his teacher in Thailand was dying, and he went to Thailand because he wanted to hear some last words from his teacher, and he was hoping that he was going to be given some really, you know, unique and special gift of teaching to keep with him. And when he met with his teacher, you know, and begged for these last words, his teacher said to him, know the difference between the mind and the activities of the mind. Learn to know the difference between the mind and the activities of the mind. And he said at first he felt really quite disappointed. But then when he reflected on this, he began to understand how profound it was. That it was a teaching about spaciousness. I'll give you an example. If you walk into this room, probably at first we might just find our attention to drawn to all of the things that are in this room. We notice the chairs, the cushions, the people, the bell, you know, the things hanging from the ceiling. What would it be like to make a small shift and instead of focusing on all the things in this room, to notice the space in this room? It is the space in this room that holds everything that's in the room. You and me, everything that's here. And the space in this room really doesn't depend upon getting rid of any of the things in this room. Doesn't deny their right to be here. The space in this room is not possessive. It's not about mine or your things. When we look at the things in this room, we might find things that interest us or excite us. We might find things that we dislike, other things that we like. The space in this room is actually pretty calm and still. It has no preferences. It's what makes it possible for everything to be here, for us to be here. It is the space in this room that accommodates everything in it. Another way of noticing that space, if we take just a moment to listen wholeheartedly, all of the different sounds that are here, me talking, sounds outside, all the sounds in our day, some of them are lovely, some of them are not so lovely. What would it mean to make a little shift and to notice the silence between the sounds. Notice the way that the sounds emerge out of that silence and fall back into it. Now, the silence is really not denied by the sounds. The sounds can be delightful, they can be repelling. But the silence is something that's very calm, very still, very spacious. Learning to notice the space around thoughts, around people, around sounds, I think offers us a very different way of holding everything that appears in that space. And it's a way of seeing our own mind and heart. I mean, a spacious mind has room for everything. It's unshaken by what appears. The contracted mind always feels too full, too overflowing. So we learn to notice the difference between the mind and the activities of the mind. We tend not to notice that difference because we become so mesmerized by everything that appears in the space. We become so mesmerized by the thoughts, by the images, by the regrets, by the plans, that we tend not to notice the space out of which all of those thoughts emerge and they fall back into. Now, noticing space, just making it a practice, is something that's very subtle because it needs attention. So, you know, spaciousness is not dramatic. It's not like some gripping pain or some delightful fantasy. To notice spaciousness, we need to know what it means to step back a little, to calm down a little, and to contemplate the space, the spaciousness that is here. Here in the waterfall of our thinking that arises out of stillness and falls back into stillness. I think one of the great arts of meditation practice is learning to find this balance, this marriage of spaciousness and focus. It's a great art. If we have focus, concentration, attention without spaciousness, so easily we get tight, we get contracted. If we have spaciousness without attention, so easily we just become very spacey. Now, our mindfulness of breathing is actually a great friend, a great ally in learning to find that balance. Because mindfulness of breathing is not a way to exclude or to defend against anything. But we can start to notice the space between the breaths, the space between the thoughts, to see what happens at the end of an out-breath, in the falling away of a thought. In Zen, there's that wonderful haiku that says, when your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. And our breath is an ally reminding us to see and not to be lost in unnecessary things. The unnecessary things are not the thoughts, but all the agitation, the layers of agitation, the layers of aversion, the layers of speculation, excitement that we layer upon the thoughts. Learning to contemplate spaciousness helps to find that mind of gladness. Oliver Sacks, some of you will know his writing. He once wrote something, a reflection that came to him when he was having to stop the busyness of his life as he was convalescing from a leg operation. He said, "After breakfast, I wandered out. It was a particular glorious September morning. Settled myself on a stone seat with a large view in all directions and filled and lit my pipe. This was a new, or at least almost forgotten experience. I'd never had the leisure to light a pipe before, or not, it seemed to me, for 14 years at least. Now suddenly I had an immense sense of leisure, an unhurriedness, a freedom I had almost forgotten, but which now it had returned seemed the most precious thing in life. There was an intense sense of stillness, peacefulness, joy, a pure delight in the now, freed from drive or desire. I was intensely conscious of each leaf, autumn-tinted on the ground, intensely conscious of the Eden around me. The world was motionless, frozen, everything concentrated in an intensity of sheer being. Now on this morning, I felt like Adam beholding a new world with wonder. I had not known or had forgotten that there could be such beauty, such completeness in every moment. I had no sense at all of moments of the serial, only of the perfection and beauty of the timeless now. If we take just a couple of moments quietly together.